Hello, witches. This is Kara Kovacs, and this is Business Witch. As a third-generation witch, at least, and a business and life coach for mission-driven entrepreneurs and leaders, I teach you how to make money and magic as liberatory practices. Because when we know, seek, and embrace our full potential, we create a better world for everyone. Here you'll find tools, conversations, spells, and inspiration that take you from waiting to creating so you can build the business and life you're oh so worthy and capable of having. Let's go. Hello, Bewitchers. Before we get into today's content, I just wanted to thank you for listening and let you know that if you want to support a small business owner, the best way to do that is to share about their work. In this case, I deeply appreciate your 5-star reviews on your preferred streaming platforms, resharing episodes like this one to your social media stories. I promise to reshare. Or if you feel so called to stay connected, I give free love notes with lots of business tips, advice, prompts, free classes, access to insider information on my email list every single week. You can head to www.karakovacs.com to subscribe. You'll get a curated list of our favorite episodes of this show, as well as access to lots of classes, a library of past free workshops, and tons of information to support you in your own small business journeys. So thanks so much in advance for hanging out with us on all the places, Instagram, email, and here at the podcast. Let's get into the show. Hello, witches, and welcome back to another episode of Business Witch. It is my pleasure to introduce you to today's fabulous guest. Perhaps you already follow her. Susanna Barkataki is a yoga unity activist and the author of Embracing Yoga's Roots. Welcome to the podcast. Tell the people what it means to be a yoga unity activist. And please correct me if I said anything wrong.
Yeah, I love this. And hello. I'm so excited to be here and to get to talk with you. Yeah, I mean, for me, being a yoga unity activist is connecting to that original intention of yoga to be a change maker, right? To practice these tools that come to us for thousands of years for personal and social change. And that is the essence of yoga, which is unity, you know, and bringing that together with action in the world in all the different forms, you know. So I'm a parent, I'm a teacher, I run a business, I'm also a partner. So the activism isn't just like reserved for when I call my representatives, it's in all my relationships and all the roles that I play.
I think something that my audience in particular would be really interested to hear from you, and we had talked briefly before you came on the show today. A lot of my students are yoga teacher certified or curious about getting certification or use yoga as a tool and an instrument in their own teaching or their own practices. And I'd be curious for people, both for their sake and then for people who maybe practice like myself, when they can get into the studio and for personal hobby, your differentiation about the way that we see yoga practiced, generally speaking, and what the true root of yoga is.
Yeah, I feel like, so also just to contextualize for folks, I'm an Indian woman, but I'm mixed. I was born in England and my mother is British and my father is Indian and I grew up in LA. So I'm very much in a Western context, but have grown up with an Indian father and then family from Bengal and Northeast India, Assam, in LA, right? So it's like I've had, like probably many of us have, these multicultural lives. And that opened a window for me into what was missing in yoga in the West, because I'd come from, you know, pujas or ceremonies with my family that we were doing Vedic practices or yogic practices. And then I'd try to go to a studio down the street and they were doing two completely different things. And so what's missing is, I would say, some of the ritual, some of the culture, and the like the authentic practices, by which I mean in a cultural context, yoga is a whole way of life. It's an ethical system. It's also a philosophical system. And it gives you guidance on everything, you know, like all the choices one might make. It's not so much just fitness, and it's really not just physically focused, although asana is one aspect of a yoga practice. So in the West, when we say, oh, I'm going to yoga, like we would never say that. It's like, I did my yoga, or I'm doing my yoga. It's more of a full way of being, I would say, in the like in a sort of Indian or more authentic context. Now, I do want to kind of highlight, though, there's a lot of stuff that passes for quote unquote authentic that's really problematic. There's patriarchy, there's, you know, caste oppression. So it's not like we can say, oh, just go back to the original roots of yoga and we're fine. No, some of those roots are honestly really messed up, and we don't want to bring that forward. And so it's also about kind of a discernment between what are we bringing forward and what are we saying? We don't want those things. And I would call those some of the first appropriations of yoga, actually, the Brahminical patriarchy, because sometimes you'll hear this misstatement that yoga was always practiced by men. Well, that's not true. There have always been female and other, you know, gender expansive yoga practitioners. Historically, Mirabai and, you know, early even like Shakti and Parvati were practitioners in the stories. But the Brahminical patriarchy tells us, and then brought yoga out of the purview of being accessible to everyone, and said, oh, only, you know, Brahmin men have access to the divine. And that is not something we want to bring back, right? So I want to make clear, we're not saying like all the roots are what we want. It's being discerning about what we want to bring forward.
I mean, that sounds also like so much of what we collectively are looking at, whether it's decolonization or the dismantling of other systems of oppression and how intersectional that is as an experience. It's not just noticing one thing or one segment of one thing. Like, we are all swimming in a soup of sometimes combating, sometimes complementary, and altogether confusing messaging that we need to discern, like, what do we want to keep and what do we want to take? And I'm curious for you as a business owner and also as a practitioner, what it was like cultivating a methodology where you held all of that.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because my path to being a business owner, I was a teacher. I was a high school teacher, and I taught in public LA public schools for over a decade. And I that also traveled to India because, you know, as teachers, we got great leave, you know, and great time off. So I was able to travel back and forth and learn with my teacher who's in Bihar doing work as a Brahmin, teaching outcast and Dalit folks yoga tools, right, and yogic practices, which is pretty radical for, you know, for that context of India. So one, he said to me, what the West needs is yoga ethics. And after I'd been back like 2 years and stayed there, he's like, you need to go and share this in your community. And I was like, okay, I hear you. So I moved back from India to LA and was working again in a different school. And then my colleagues and my classmates and like, not classmate, well, like people who work sort of in the field working in education or other nonprofits started to ask me because they could see the changes in me that yoga was bringing. And they were like, hey, we want to learn yoga. We want to learn and take a teacher training, but we want to take it from an Indian person, from an authentic teacher, from someone who understands that we're working with like people in addiction recovery or people, you know, with trauma and who gets that and who's bringing like the lens of the roots of yoga and also like teaching to the communities that they're teaching and practicing with and caring for. So they were like, hey, can you teach me? You know, so I kind of fell into business, running a business, almost not by accident. Well, it was kind of by accident. It was kind of like just the request of the community. And I did that from around 2012 through 2015, when I lost my job, my teaching job, my primary income. And so it was at that time, and so did my partner, and we had to move across the country from LA to Orlando for a job opportunity that he got because we couldn't find any work in LA, neither of us. We had a little baby, 2.5-year-old, and that was a really hard time. It was like the universe was like, felt like we were being kicked out of LA, you know, and I was being kicked out of, I thought we were going to live in that house and my kid would go to the school I worked at. It was so challenging, right? So my path to running a business was actually like, okay, I'm here in Florida. I have a little leeway. I don't have to run out and find a job right away. Let's try this yoga training, you know, on the side. And then I think it was a good friend who was like, what if, why don't you just make this your business? Why are you trying to do other things? You know, you have these people coming to you. So I then was like, let's make sure the curriculum honors the roots, but also always cares for the communities and the context that we're in. So it's always been this kind of dance between making sure that it's accessible and trauma informed and, you know, up to date with kind of the latest and best practices, and then also has the philosophy and the energetic roots. And I go back and check with, you know, some of my root teachers as well. I think that's helped. But truly, and for folks who practice yoga, right? Because even if you don't practice yoga, I just want to say, like, it's pretty universal that there are ethical principles, whether it's in business or in your spiritual practice or personal life, that we can come back to. So it's like, come back to those ethical principles. If I'm off or if you're off, it's like, what do I need to do to get back in alignment with those? Both of us have a colleague who's always teaching this, Trudy, in business as well. And so that, and then also that kind of care for how am I taking care of myself, my community, the world. And so I continually come back to those questions in the work that I do. And that so far, it's led me really well.
There were so many things that I loved in what you said, but one thing I want to highlight that I think my people need to hear is that often a really scary change or transition that happens beyond your control that you think is really bad is the catalyst for being like, I'm finally going to put energy into doing this thing that something inside of me has been like, you should really do that for a while. And I'm curious for you what that process was like, if you could speak to it a little bit more.
The process of learning to trust myself and to trust the practice, I almost feel like it's like a video game, you know, it's like this challenge would come up and I develop and learn the skills to manage that. And then it's like, okay, next level unlocked, this challenge, then this challenge, and then this challenge. Some of the biggest things that I learned was I needed to learn mood management and stress management for running a business. Because if I allowed my moods or my whims to run my day or my decision-making process, I wasn't going to be able to stay consistent enough. You know, when we work for someone else, in a way you can kind of skate by, but when you're both the implementer and the boss, and sometimes the project manager and the VA, right? And because I was at the beginning, I had to be able to get through my resistance or my blocks and still get the thing done. So that emotional management was really key, and yoga for me really helped with that, and stress management as well. I honestly think having the team, you know, having supportive community. So that could be like business besties or a good friend who believed in what I was doing and understood and cared and would ask, and just someone who was like cheerleading me on. So key. And then I also had to identify there were people in my life who felt like detractors or doubters. You know, for many of us, it might be family, blood family, or even just like friends that don't quite get where you're going. And I had to be at that time very protective and have boundaries and not share my new ideas with them, because it was going to deflate me. And then I'd have to do all that work of coming back. Now it's funny, you know, I can go and talk to those same people and I'm like, yes, bring on the critiques. Let me know what you think, because I want to make this thing better, you know, and it doesn't impact me on that deep level. But I also only do it when I'm in a strong, like, self-secure place. And I wasn't, which is okay. You know, it doesn't mean we have to have everything figured out. I certainly didn't. I think those are the main things, the team. Oh, and then I would say getting support, right? Like, I reached out and learned from coaches. At first, a lot of it was like exchange. Like, I would give them energy work or yoga teacher training, even for business coaching. because I didn't have those skills. I studied philosophy as my major. It was so wonderful, but totally not. I had no, you know, and I was a teacher, right? So I had no background in business. And so entering the programs, taking the training, getting the coaches, whether it's one-on-one or signing up for, you know, like what you offer, I went from coach to coach to coach, or program to program to program over the first like 3 to 3 years of my business. At the time, I also thought, let me learn these new things. And then I got to a point where I said, let me stay with the same person and just go deeper, because I no longer need the outside, like the different methodologies. I just need to keep working on my own mindset and continue to grow and really work on what I know. You know, it's no longer about like learning from the outside, but just someone helping me refine. So there's so many ways to go about it, but really I think it's like belief and then self-trust, team, and education.
I think there's so much wisdom in what it is that you just shared, because what you just walked people through is being on the other side of what so many of my students are in the process of. And when you're in it, I understand how much scarier it is, because you're thinking things like, is it actually going to work, or am I meant to do this? And I always advise people, don't get business advice from someone who's never had the kind of business that you have. And I think that there's a lot of, you know, you when you say it now, it's like, you sound like you knew exactly what you were doing. And I'm sure it did not look that way in the process.
Yeah, the truth is, like, some of the stuff I'm about to put out, I still think, is it even going to work? Right? Like, it. The truth is, those things don't necessarily go away. There is no guarantee. Like, there, I run that things where sometimes there's 3,000 people on a training, and sometimes there's 30, and sometimes there's no one. Okay. So just because we've succeeded once or something's worked once doesn't mean it's going to work again. There's no guarantees. And there's so many things that kind of have to align. And I think that's the one other thing, is like being okay with experimentation. Mm-hmm. And it's failed if I put out a workshop and, like, you know, it's all relative, but say 20 people come and I'm used to, you know, 2,000 or something. It's like, that's not a failure. That's just information and feedback. Yeah. So yeah, it, and the me that started, like, I can't imagine going back and telling her, like, you will have 10,000 people join an event, like a yoga summit that you do that's free. Mm. She would have been like, what are you talking about? I have 6 people in my backyard for a yoga moon ceremony.
amazing.
Skills developed along the way, you know, and so, yeah, just trusting the process and not really taking failure, like quote unquote failure, right? It's just information and feedback.
Yeah, it's data. And I think it's hard to see it as data when it feels personal, because you like bond your self-worth as a human being, not even as a business owner, but like as a person, and your likability in with your perception of results. But there's so much wisdom to be gleaned from what you just shared. So like, maybe people want to rewind and listen to it again, or like save this episode for when they're in that moment of like, is it going to work? And I think even like work is a relative term, because having 5 people show up for your first offering is a huge win, even if you wanted 30 of them, or making $5,000 when you wanted to make $25,000 when you're testing, not that whether the idea was good or not. It's not actually really about the quality of the idea. It's also about how you marketed it, how you communicated it, how you felt when you were selling it. And people think it's like, oh, it was the idea, it didn't work, I'm bad, I'm wrong, and they stop. Mm-hmm. And that makes me feel really sad, because it's also making you feel bad about yourself in probably an unnecessary way. And it's keeping people from finding your incredible work when you look at it and you're like, okay, that I still love this idea. Like, how could I have shared about it differently? Was I being clear in how I shared about it? You talk on your platform about how imposter syndrome has its roots in white supremacy. And I feel like this is a good kind of segue into getting your opinions about that.
Yeah. I do want to say one thing, which is like, the other big thing is, like, my white yoga teacher trainings, for example, or a student joining them, whether it's one or five or 20, that is not the source of my abundance. Mm-hmm. And it also isn't the source of my self-validation of how good of a teacher I am. It's whatever your definition of God, divine, the universe, energy, source. Like for me, it's, am I good with yoga? Are me and yoga, yoga as unity, yoga as everything is interconnected. Good. And if I make people that source, I'm disconnecting from that original spiritual connection. And also I'm making a complex and not so supportive relationship with those people. So a big part, the spiritual part, it's like, you know, Business Witch podcast, right? It's like, there is a way that our spiritual practices are doing the work that they need to do, the alchemy that we need them to do for ourselves and for the people who may come. And so if I put together, like I just put together a new program and it's so good and I'm so in love with it. And I really thought about what are the issues like imposter syndrome and other things that people need to heal. But whether 5 or 10 or 50 or 100 people sign up for that, the program itself is a divine, you know, it's like a channeled teaching that has come through me that I am in love with and that I'm really grateful for, regardless of what the outcome is. So in the Bhagavad Gita, it says, do every action you must do and do not be attached to your actions' fruits.
Mm.
So it's shloka or section 2.4678. And the message there is like, do what is yours, right? Like your dharma, your purpose. And of course, it doesn't mean you ignore what your people need, but your people aren't the source of the validation. It's the relationship with the divine.
I want to say that any person I have ever met who has a sort of magnetism about them that makes people fall in love with their content, and I consider you one of those people, is doing it because of that deep spiritual resonance and channeling. And it's like, so they're in their work and in their purpose. And it's a pattern I've seen in a lot of the guests on this podcast, for example, where they're teaching something they're so in love with that people want to learn about it. And so they didn't care who was in the room. They were so excited to talk about it. And the reason I brought up imposter syndrome is in my community, there is that, well, if people aren't there and I didn't make money, it didn't work, and I'm not going to be financially okay. And when you're starting out and in the earlier phases, I think that tying of one, validation, but two, financial safety and security to those outcomes cuts the energetic transmission of like, you originally wanted to do this because you were obsessed with fill in the blank thing that you wanted to share with people. And so I hope that people can take what you said and use it as a reminder. And what we teach in Business Witch is that you start with your why and then you come back to your why whenever you deviate from it. And that's what builds your marketing strategy. Like that's what the entire philosophy of the first module is. And people, I notice in the program, they try to write their why like an Instagram bio. And I'm like, that's not the point of the question. The point of the question is like, why do you do this? And then I'll ask somebody, and they'll say it off the cuff. They've been like agonizing over how to write it perfectly for 3 days. They've put 5 drafts in the Facebook group. And then they come on a call and I'm like, okay, but why do you do this? And it just flows out of them. They don't have to think about it. It sounds great. And I'm like, yeah, that, like, stop trying to write it in like a consumable content copy format.
Oh, yeah. It's like, we don't have to try. It just sort of is what we're becoming, you know? And I think imposter syndrome makes it really hard. I also want to say capitalism makes it really hard. And I don't want to downplay. Because the other thing that people don't talk about is they're like, oh, my business made this or made this or made this. But like, where were you starting from? Like, did you have a partner who could help fund? Did you have trust fund money? You know, that. And so I want to also just kind of lay out so folks can hear, I had some support. I had been a teacher. I had that. It was a stable income, you know, for me as a single person. At that point, when I started my business, I was married. My partner had a job. we had supported each other. There's no trust fund. It was just like teacher salary and landscape architecture salary. But I got a little bit of like an inheritance at the time, you know, not huge, but enough that I didn't have to look for a job right away. And my partner was supportive and said, I will carry the majority of like the rent and the food while you get this business off the ground. Obviously, we'll talk if you need to go back to work, if we need more. And so I had this supportive person that also was supporting me around finances and not putting that pressure on it. My partner is a Virgo. And it's like unbelievable to me because money stress is a big thing, right? So the fact that that wasn't put on me at the beginning of the budding time of my business was huge. And so I just want to name those privileges because they absolutely are privileges that at that point I was out of educational debt. I was out of credit card debt. I paid those off because of my job. And there were like those 3 years between when I was sort of ready to start and then when I actually started, where I was working, you know, whatever, it's not 9 to 5, teaching is like 7 to 3 or whatever, but I was working that job, holding on to that income so I didn't have to put the financial stress on what I loved. So it can be okay to hold yourself in this transition time, and that there's no rule book for how long or short that is. That can change for people. So I just want to name those things too, because it's all good and well to be like, God is my source, but then how do I pay for food or like my child's diapers or, you know? So yeah. It's kind of like, well, having that plan allows for the faith. And also there have been things that have been irrational, like that only could have happened for me also because I had faith. Like they're both true.
Yes, I love that. I want to talk about imposter syndrome, and I want to talk about decolonizing mindfulness, because I feel like you kind of just did, where you were talking about like, yes, there were things that were magical, and then there's also these like real world factors that are playing into everyone's experiences of wealth. So like when you're scrolling on Instagram and someone's like, I manifested a 6-figure month, and you're like, okay, but what is your relationship to ancestral trauma around money? And I want to share, I don't think I've ever shared this on the podcast, but an example from my own life that was kind of both. It was like a divine permission slip and a real life circumstance. When I dropped out of grad school because I was like, I'm paying more for a year of grad school than I will make in a year as a social worker. And I financially am like, I don't understand that math. So I'm not doing this. I took a job that I hated and I was deeply depressed. I have never been so depressed as working at that job. And it was hard. It was awful. I did it for a couple of years. I needed health insurance. It was what it was. But when I was thinking about, do I go back to grad school and like just go more into debt and become a therapist? And then I discovered the coaching universe kind of around the same time. There was a divine series of events where I actually was able to negotiate because of some work circumstances I will not talk about on the podcast. Another story for another day. But I was actually able to negotiate 6 months of paid severance and my health insurance for a year and a half. And so it was like the real world circumstances of I was funded. And that seems almost too magical to be a real experience.
Yeah, it's funny. There's very few like femmes, witches, folks of color who I know who haven't been, one, discriminated against, and two, often fired or let go, right? And sometimes we get these boons or these blessings, like severance. Or mine was, I had a severance from the job I left or was let go of, that was because I brought up race and gender discrimination. And so I kind of look at these moments as like, it's not like payback, because there's no way to atone for all of the gender, you know, and pay gap, race, equity, pay gap over the generations, generational wealth. But I don't feel bad about it. Like we should take it when and where we can get it, because those are things that allow us to then say yes to new opportunities. But even those moments, I feel like this goes back to imposter syndrome. We can feel like frauds. We can downplay our own accomplishments, our own worthiness, you know, always being concerned about being exposed, about being incompetent or incapable. Like, it's actually this really intense disease of perception that is an inability to internalize our own successes. And part of that can come from, you know, self-esteem, self-worth, sure. But I actually think it's way deeper than that and systemic too, like, you know, ableism, classism, racism, heteronormativity, gender discrimination, that for me, it's helpful when I can look at and say, oh, these are systemic issues that are telling someone like me, you know, or looks like me or talks or sounds or, you know, comes from the background I come from, that we're never going to be as good and that we don't deserve whatever these opportunities. And so it actually helps me feel better about it, not just being an inside job, because it's actually systemic oppression. And we talk about internalized depression. I do think for many of us, a huge part of imposter syndrome is internalized depression. And I actually like the reframe of that from internalized to injected, meaning, because internalized, again, puts the onus on us. Like, oh, you're oppressed and you messed up because you internalized it, right? Like, but injected is like it's being forced on us. And so for me, when I realized that, it's like, oh, so believing in myself, caring for myself, advocating for myself is actually part of creating systemic change. Now I see how important that is. It was almost like I had to trick myself into getting through the imposter syndrome and insecurity by seeing that it was for a greater cause to create systemic change.
Yeah. Like as you were saying it, it begs this question, or I thought of this question and I'm like, I wonder how this question is going to come off, but I'm going to ask you it anyway. Was it easier to do when it was for other people than when it was for you? And do you think that that is a symptom of the same thing that we're talking about?
Yeah. For me, it was. Yeah, it was because that I was so shy. I was so insecure. Like I was in a speech class in college and I left when I had to give a speech and never went back. And I wanted to like please my teachers. I was a good student. And I couldn't get over my insecurities, my inability to be seen. There wasn't that, like it wasn't working. I had been in therapy, again, another privilege, I would say, since I was a teenager. And it helped, but didn't really help. You know what I mean? Like nothing had quite shifted it until I made this connection with like, oh, it is part of my contribution to help shift this. And so, yeah, it was not. And now I'm like, it's both. And there's so many great, I think it's especially Black femmes who, and queer femmes who are leading the work. You know, like I think of like Rest is Resistance and Trisha Hersey's work, Octavia Rahim and the yoga world. If we go back, you've got like Angela Davis and Audre Lorde and bell hooks. Like all their work is around intersectional oppression, but also care for oneself as a form of liberation. Mm-hmm. And so looking at the guidance and the leadership and paying that respect and also understanding, like, for me, it's like if Angela Davis or if Patrice Cullors, who's the founder of Black Lives Matter, one of the co-founders, is saying, like, we need to take care of ourselves. And as women or queer folks or people of color, you know, white folks, like part of dismantling these systems is like not surrendering our humanity. Mm-hmm. Then that helps me see and feel the absolute necessity of that for movement work. Mm-hmm. Right. I feel like that's been a key too, is like find the examples, the everyday, some of them are like big, you know, names like bell hooks or Angela Davis, but there's also everyday folks that we can learn from and take inspiration from. And, you know, that has really helped with imposter syndrome, is like calling up the myths, naming them, and then like seeing its overlap with perfectionism and self-punishment and withholding and all of these things, procrastination, right? Like, and then finding antidotes, like what makes me feel worthy? how can I practice self-compassion and self-forgiveness? And then really being in that practice of acknowledging, like when people used to give me a compliment, it would be like, oh no, you know, or like, oh, but you, it's like, no, let it, like, this is a yogic practice too. Like really just receive. And what does it feel like to be in the practice of like, thank you. You know, if someone's like, I loved your book, it really changed my life or my work or my yoga. Thank you. And then I might move to asking or, you know, inquiring, what are they doing or they're, you know, but not deflecting. And that really started the shift. And I would say now, I mean, of course, I still feel insecure and I still feel imposter syndrome, but they don't run the show. I have moved through them where I can speak and teach and share in a, I don't know if I want to say confident, but in a consistent way that is sometimes confident, and sometimes I'm doing it and I'm scared and I'm nervous and I'm doing it anyway.
Yeah, that's so, so beautiful. I appreciated that so much. And I think when I work with one-on-one clients, oftentimes they're very surprised by how much parts work we do as business coaching, because I always see that when, even what you just said, at the imposter syndrome part is not running the show. I like to use the metaphor of a car. Like, they need to be strapped into a child safety seat in the back, and you need to give them an iPad so they can't like be like, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? And like running the inner dialogue, and who do you want in the front seat of the car making the business decisions? And I think whether it's imposter syndrome or fear about money, and whether that's a self-directed thing or influenced by capitalism and external cultural context, you want the part of you that is most capable of and best suited for serving and for running your business to be driving the car. But because we don't have an awareness that all of those parts are valid, but their perspectives can be conflicting, we're not even tapped into who is guiding the decision-making. We just felt an instinct and then we did it. And it was like, you want to run something that it'll be your career for the rest of your life. You want to maybe slow it down a bit to really get to the heart of what's the impetus that's trying to take this particular action.
Yeah.
So one more thing I'd love to talk to you about today is, if we are going to studios in our local communities and we want to be avid and active and ethical participants in yogic community, what advice do you have for us in being in spaces where maybe we notice some things that aren't the best, or participating in a way where we get to be ethics rooted, even if we want to go to a studio, but we can't seem to find one that we like, which I feel like is a situation that I've seen my friends run into.
Yeah, I mean, yoga is a path and a practice that's here to support all of our liberation. And it's also an in-depth and complex system. And so what's tricky about practicing in studios is sometimes it's like they have a little piece of the system, but it's disconnected from that whole, and it's done in a way that can be appropriative or even, you know, sometimes harmful, especially if it's like really fitness oriented or not trauma informed, not inclusive of disabilities or all bodies. And I do think the industry is changing, but it's not yet changed kind of on a widespread scale. So a lot of my work and creating an app that will come out sometime later this year, maybe mid-year, that'll be free, that's a place where my vision for it is that down the line, so it'll be kind of like Instagram and Insight Timer, but diverse body positive, you know, trauma-informed yoga. And so you'd be able to scroll and be like, okay, back pain, bigger body, you know, and person of color, whatever you might want to look for. So you can practice with someone like you, or authentic yoga, you know, stress management, right? And so, and also it'll have pranayama, which is breath work, mantra, which is sound, mudra, which is like sacred gesture, all these different aspects from the yogic tradition. And one of the motivations for creating this is so the general population first understands that yoga can provide everyday solutions to everyday problems, or tools that can help at least. And then two, I hope that in the future, we can walk into a studio and be like, hey, I can get this here on this app. Like, where's your bigger body teachers, or where's your teachers who are trauma informed or who can teach pranayama, or, you know, like, but we're not there. Mm-hmm. And so as practitioners or going into these studios, I first and foremost actually think it's important to, like you're talking about, like protect our own peace, like especially if we're business owners or we're starting a business and we really need to kind of essentially get our heads right and our emotions aligned. Like, we need to go there to just get what we need. And that is important. And if you have the space, if you have the capacity and you see or hear something that you're like, that feels a little out of alignment, or like there's a deity in the bathroom, or just a use of a practice that's not quite respecting the tradition, and you have the capacity to speak up, I would say definitely speak up. You can refer people to my articles. I have a ton of them. They're, again, free, or my book, or a free chapter of the book, because sometimes it can be helpful to be like, hey, I was reading this article by Susanna Barkataki about decolonizing yoga. What do you think? You know, like, I would say getting on the same side with folks as opposed to being like combative. And then asking for what you want. If what you're wanting is like, hey, I'd love if there was kirtan, or like this yoga of sound led here, or yoga nidra led here. And it would be so cool if it was led by, you know, folks who are from within the tradition. Would you ever hire, or have you considered, you know, reaching out to a workshop? Like, that can go a really long way to creating a different culture in the space that you're in. But it also takes work, and not every studio is going to be open. You know, I do think we're in a transition. I think in the next 3 to 5 years, the in-person yoga landscape will be very different than it is now. But we're in this time of shift, and we can all be part of that, you know?
And if people want to be part of it, I know you're hosting a free class. Maybe that's a good place to start. Do you want to share the details for that?
Yes, I'm so excited about it. It'll be on yoga social. It's called Yoga Social Justice Masterclass, and it's Must Know Yoga Philosophy for Personal and Social Change. So I'll be going into some of the key and core ideas from the yamas, which is like the yogic tenets in the Yoga Sutras, for how we can bring those alive in our lives and in our world. And then after that, I'll be running a 300-hour yoga teacher training, which you can learn more about too.
And if people want to learn more about the class, the yoga teacher training, and your other offerings, we will obviously link them in the show notes, but where would you direct them?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, Instagram, because it's all going to be in the link on my bio in Instagram. And also, I have so much fun like sharing ideas and thoughts. And I just, my Instagram page is like, it's like free education in with like humor and quirkiness and playfulness and sometimes trends and like real talk around how we can apply yoga to our lives.
What I do want to share about that too is I just released an episode. This episode that we're recording right now will come out in the future, but I just released an episode about how to make a profit without social media. And what I say in that episode is that the clients who I see who are making profit from using social media are having fun and actually enjoy using the platform. And that a sign that you don't need social media to make profit in your business is that actually approaching making content makes you feel like you're operating outside of the scope of your authenticity to try to conform to whatever is trending on the platform. And that there is value in like studying marketing trends if you want to use that platform, but that it's not necessary. And I think that your account is a really good example of someone who looks like they're having fun, and that's why it works.
It's so true. Yeah, I wouldn't do it if it wasn't fun. And I will say it's been really effective also, you know, but I think it is effective because it's also fun for me. I really like ideas, and I like sharing ideas, and I also like kind of bringing them together and sharing them in simplified or bite-sized ways, like complex philosophical topics or yogic topics. And then I like the community and the conversations. It's really a place of joy, which I know for some people is like not, but I also did, I want to say this, I made a decision for my accountant, it's not about me, Susanna Barkataki. Like, I don't post my kid that much, you know, or my personal life. Like, I'm starting to learn to play bass guitar. No one would know that, you know, from my social. I chose to make it about education, like education, empowerment. And that has helped a lot. So again, it's that sort of the parigraha in yoga. It's the detachment from, like, my social media isn't a validation of me. It's just, I'm going to offer some educational tools and I'm the vehicle for those tools. But whether a post gets 5 likes or 500, it doesn't change how I feel about myself. And that has made the world of difference, because then it's more about, like, did the education work? You know, was this a good communication of this idea, or how can I refine it or change it? And that really helped.
So we ask 2 questions on every episode of this show. The first one I know the answer to, but tell all of the listeners, what's your sun, moon, rising?
Yes. My sun is Pisces and my rising sign is Leo. And the funny story about that is I have a family member who's a Leo, and I was like, oh, they're so conceited and they're so self-absorbed. And I hate Leo. I'm proud that my rising sign was a Leo.
The reason I like asking that question on this podcast is because when I am listening to other people's podcasts, I'm like, what is their sign the entire time? So I just like to, like, provide that for people listening here, because that's always the question I have in my head. And then the final question is, what's your why? Why do you do what you do?
I want to make the world a better place. And I truly have not found a better pathway or tool or system to do that than yogic practices. They've changed my life. And so my why is, like, I'm sharing the pathway to liberation, and I hope that it makes the world better for as many people as possible.
Thank you so much for being here. If you want to take Susanna's classes or read her book, you can head to the show notes and get the link to her Instagram. And I will see you witches next time on Business Witch. Bye for now.